This is the first day of this November 2014 7-day session. And we'll start off the session reading from an old favorite. This is a collection of early Zen texts from the Dunhuang Caves in China. The book is called Zen Dawn, and it was translated by J.C. Cleary. The book consists of three texts. The first is Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka. The second is Bodhidharma's Treatise on Contemplating Mind. And third one is, just to finish it, Treatise on the True Sudden Enlightenment School of the Great Vehicle, which opens up mind and reveals reality nature. So we'll concentrate on the first of these, the Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka. The introduction tells us that these texts, what he refers to as here is meditation manuals that are translated in this volume, are among the earliest surviving records of Chan Buddhism in Zen Buddhism in China, Chan. These texts were lost for centuries, for many centuries, and then were rediscovered in the desert, the northwestern, the Gobi Desert of China, in the last century, the 20th century. This, for me, was one of the high points of one of my pilgrimages to China, was getting across the desert to the Dunhuang Caves. As I remember, these caves were discovered by a British explorer, archaeologist by the name of Arnold Stein, who was tipped off by some Buddhist monks that the caves were a treasure of figures, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They're actually a whole bunch of grottos. It's not just one or two or three big caves, but many more than that. And it's a very, very dry part of the desert. And somehow these ancient texts have been preserved there in the arid climate. Stein made off with these figures and thousands of scrolls, which is how the sutras and old texts were made. They weren't made in books, but in scrolls. And he had a great caravan, camels, and others who laborers who got this back to the British Museum in 1986, when there was a big Buddhist exhibition in the British Museum, and I finally saw what I had read about there, including some of these texts. They're dated to the 8th century, the first half of the 8th century, which is the Tang Dynasty. But this first section about the earliest masters predates the Tang Dynasty. So there's a long, interesting introduction here, but it's mostly historical things and different aspects of Buddhist doctrine. So I'm going to skip that, as I usually do, and go right to the root source. And it's these texts are attributed to a monk by the name of Jing Jue. The original preface to these texts, it says that it begins by saying in brackets that the text was broken off, and so we lost the first part of it. And then in the words of this Jing Jue, he says, it was evident that the great teacher Xuanzi had long since consummated the path. This is not Xuanzi, the great Taoist sage, but it's a different spelling, so apparently it was a Chan master. And this author, Jing Jue, says in 708 he was called by imperial summons to the western capital. He preached the methods of Chan widely in the eastern capital. So this sort of sets the stage. And then and then we go to section one, which is about a master by the name of Guna Bahadra. Section two is Bodhidharma. This Guna Bahadra, I remember coming across that name somewhere in my reading, but the few books that I have here at Chapin Mill aren't the ones that would remind me of where I'd heard of this guy. But it's interesting, you know, we always think of Bodhidharma as the first patriarch of Zen. He came from southern India. Well, this Guna Bahadra also came from southern India. And I'll just read here the translation. Guna Bahadra Tripitaka was a man of South India. When he studied the great vehicle, he was called Mahayana. That's what Mahayana means, is great vehicle. Of course, there are two main streams of Buddhist teaching, the Mahayana, of which Zen is a part, and the Theravada. I'm not going to say Hinayana, because Hinayana is a kind of a disparaging term used by Mahayanists. Maha means great, great vehicle. Mahayana, great vehicle. Hinayana means small vehicle. Those Buddhists who are not in the Mahayana don't call themselves Hinayanists. They call themselves Theravadists. It's the path of the elders. So back to Guna Bahadra. When he studied the great vehicle, he was called Mahayana, suitably enough. During the Yuan Jia years, and the years here are 424 to 454, so again, that predates Bodhidharma. During the 400s, he came by ship to Guangzhou. Now, this is exactly what we've learned about Bodhidharma. Is he left southern India by ship and a three-year journey landed in the southern part of China called Guangzhou. Emperor Taizu of the Song received him at Danyang Commandery. He translated the Lankavatara Sutra. Some of you will remember that the Lankavatara Sutra is considered Bodhidharma's favorite sutra, and one that he presented to his successor, Wei Ko. So there's some parallels here between this Guna Bahadra and Bodhidharma. He translated the Lankavatara Sutra. Princes and nobles, monks and laymen invited him to give instructions on meditation, but Guna Bahadra was embarrassed and declined because he did not speak Chinese well. The same thing, by the way, was said about Bodhidharma. That night he dreamed. Now, he's in China, and he's from South India, southern India, and he's in China, so he declined to speak about the Dharma in Chinese. That night he dreamed that a man took off his head with a sword. Thenceforth he began to give lessons on meditation. You know, some of these very early texts, and this one dates back, as we just heard, to the year 708. The language can be a little opaque. It's sometimes it's a little difficult to understand how one thing follows from the next. But it's wonderful to have such an ancient source, have the direct translation from such an ancient source. And I think sometimes we just have to accept that some things about these ancient texts and the expression of them is just going to have to remain a little bit opaque. Guna Bahadra said, "This country is located in the east and lacks methods of cultivating the way." So this was before before Zen, before Chan in China. There had been Buddhism. Buddhism, the first Buddhist temple was in 68 A.D., but it was a different kind of Buddhism. It certainly wasn't Chan. And so he's referring here to the methods. This country is located in the east, that is, China is located in the east, and lacks methods of cultivating the way. Cultivating is another word for practicing. So here he's saying whatever Buddhism has reached this world of this middle kingdom called China, it's not the practical methods of Chan. He continues, "Since they lack such methods, some fall into the teachings of the lesser vehicle," we're back to the Hinayana, "and the two vehicles. Some fall into the teachings of the 95 kinds of outside paths. Some fall into demonic meditation in order to view all things and find out the good and bad deeds of other people." These methods of demonic meditation are for the purpose of cultivating trance states and paranormal psychic states in order to view all things and find out the good and bad deeds of other people, mind reading or something. And then he says about that, he says, "How bitter, what a great misfortune. They entrap themselves and entrap others. I feel sorry for these types who fall for long ages into demonic paths, subject to birth and death, and do not attain liberation. Some fall into forbidden magical arts, controlling spirits and demons, spying on other people's good and bad deeds. They falsely say, 'I sit in meditation and practice contemplation.' Ordinary people are blind and deluded and do not understand and think that such magicians have indeed realized the path of the sages, and they submit to them. They do not know that these are perverse, demonic methods." So who knows what all that was that he's alluding to, but it certainly does not have the utter groundedness and simplicity of what we call the way. Zen. What these things that he refers to have in common is they're all forms of meditation in which you're trying to create certain effects. And Zen doesn't do that. We're not trying to create effects in Zen. We're trying to let the mind settle so that we can see into the ground of mind. We're not trying to do anything. We're just working to have the mind reveal itself. Continues, this Guna Bahadra continues, in our land we have the correct teaching, but it is secret and not openly transmitted. So, our land, does he mean India or China? Those who have an affinity with it and whose faculties are fully prepared meet good and wise teachers on the road who bestow it on them. If not for encounters with good and wise teachers, there would be no transmission. I love this word, affinity. Those who have an affinity with it. It takes it out of the realm of right and wrong. It's the right kind of practice or the wrong kind, the greater or the lesser vehicle, and just puts it squarely in terms of karmic affinity. If we have a karmic affinity, if there's a match, then we will practice it. If there is no such affinity or not enough affinity with it, then we won't practice it. We may practice something else with which we have a greater affinity. People who are devout Christians have an affinity with Christianity. People who are devout Jews have an affinity with Judaism. And so forth. Islam. There's no right or wrong religion. It's a wonderful thing that there are so many different religions and sects of religion, because there's such diversity in among people. Of course, different people will have affinities with different paths. This is just as it should be. Makes perfect sense. Of course, anyone who comes to a sesshin has a very strong affinity with the Dharma. How deep it runs, we don't know until we've been doing it for many years. Then we just know by looking back that we must have a deep affinity with it. But in the beginning, who knows? Might just be a temporary conjoining, and then something that passes. Affinity is such a nice kind of neutral word that applies to any kind of relationship, not just the relationship between individuals and religions, but the relationship among individuals, in interpersonal relationships. Our friends, our family, our the people with whom we work, these are all manifestations of affinity. But how strong or how deep the affinity is, we only know through time. Even marriage, of course, means affinity, karmic affinity. But same thing. We only know after, in through time, how strong, how deep that affinity is. And we don't have to make divorce something terrible. It often is, unfortunately. It often comes with great animosity and bitterness that can last for many years, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be that the very strong affinity we have with someone at a certain point then later runs its course, and that is just what it is. We go in different directions. Remember Roshi Kaplo talking about this. I would assist him at many ceremonies, and including weddings, and he would always give just some opening words in weddings for the sake of family and friends who were at the wedding. He would just, most of whom in those years had pretty much zero understanding of Zen, and he would mention some terms that are in the wedding ceremony, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and other things, and he would then mention that it is karmic affinity that has brought this bride and groom together. And when that it used to slay me right there in the weddings, and when that karmic affinity exhausts itself, they'll part. See the parents blinking in confusion. But it's true. Doesn't need to be a moral issue. The question is, with marriage, is with anything where there's a vow involved, but let's just stick with marriage for now, is when is it really a matter of the affinity having exhausted itself, and when is it something else where one is just looking elsewhere and avoiding facing one's husband or wife and finding other people to get involved with as a form of avoidance. All right, back to the text here. The Lankavatara Sutra says, "The mind of the Buddhas is supreme. When the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this." And then the author continues, "This Dharma surpasses the three vehicles and goes beyond the 10 stages. Ultimately, the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent." The fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent. Still. Mindless, meaning no-mindedly, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. This is an important point, because I'm convinced that a very common component of physical pain is mental tension. anxiety, a mind of grasping, attachment to thoughts, concepts. And that's why many people find that it's later in sesshin, after we've been sitting 10 or more hours a day, that the pain actually subsides, because we have fewer thoughts we're playing with in the mind. We've been able to let go of thoughts. Without thought, we pacify the body. Without preoccupations, we sit in purity, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. Preoccupations. Self-concerns. Thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future. At this very early stage of sesshin, there may be people still dealing with what the Chinese call trailing vines, coming into sesshin trailing vines of matters and of one's home life, family, work. Without preoccupations, we sit in purity, that is, no thought, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. Our Dharma is secret and silent. It is not transmitted by common fools of shallow consciousness. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. Well, he says here, our Dharma is secret. If it's secret, it's an open secret. It's accessible to everyone equally. It is just a matter of letting go of these trailing vines and other preoccupations. Above all, self-concerns. Letting go of self, ideas of self, of the I, the my. He continues, if you do not understand, if you are not liberated, the sixth consciousness possesses the seventh and the eighth. If you do understand, if you are liberated, the eighth consciousness is without the sixth and seventh. Okay, briefly, there are the eight in Buddhist psychology, there are eight consciousnesses. The first five are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and feeling. And the sixth consciousness, it's called the sixth of the six senses, is thinking. The seventh is that's the level of self-consciousness, of the ego, just to keep this simple. The seventh is the level of ego, where the data, what we hear, see, smell, taste, touch, feel, and think, those six senses are interpreted, become self-referential. And then the eighth is what is beyond all that. So, if you're not liberated, the sixth consciousness, that's the thinking, that which interprets the data of the other five senses, possesses the seventh and the eighth. In other words, it gets in the way of that. It kind of commandeers this what's called manas consciousness. And if you do understand, if you are liberated, then the eighth consciousness, which, just to oversimplify here, is the mind of that is beyond all that, the mind of the unconditioned, is without, is unstained by thoughts and self. He continues, those who intend to be Buddhas, that is, who intend to awaken to their Buddha nature, should first learn to pacify mind. Before mind is pacified, even good things are not good. So much the worse for evil. When mind becomes peaceful and still, neither good nor evil has any basis. So, getting beyond these dualistic notions of good and evil, getting underneath thoughts, which just means refraining from dwelling in our thoughts. When mind becomes peaceful and still, neither good nor evil has any basis. And then he quotes the Huayan Sutra, another Mahayana Sutra. Phenomena do not see each other. Phenomena do not know each other. In other words, everything is on the basis of mind. And then Guna Bahadra continues, since coming to this country, I have not even seen people who cultivate the path, much less anyone who has pacified mind. So he hasn't encountered anyone doing what Bodhidharma did, which is just silently facing the wall, turning the mind back on itself. I often see people who go along creating karma, who have not merged with the path. Some are concerned with fame and reputation. Some act for the sake of profit and support. They operate with the mentality of self and other. They act with the attitude of jealousy. What is jealousy? It means to engender the mentality of resentment and hatred when you see someone else cultivating the path and reaching consummation in principle and practice, so that many people offer support and give their allegiance. So apparently here Guna Bahadra is referring to sectarian jealousy. Maybe even toward himself. People who saw this dharma that he brought, the method of Zazen, and who reacted with resentment and hatred, seeing someone who has realized the way and becoming jealous. It means self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence, not using it to overcome self. This is called jealousy. So it's an old story. Sectarian disputes, rivalries, jealousies among different sects of the same religion, and certainly among different religions. Self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence. It's a intelligence here, small I, intelligence. Yes, small I, intelligence, really means over-reliance on the discriminating mind. Even if you scrupulously perform various practices day and night, cut off afflictions and clear away obstructions, with this kind of attitude, barriers to the path arise one after another, and you do not find peace and stillness. This is just called cultivating the path. It is not called pacifying mind. Pacifying is an unusual translation of the original Chinese. You don't see that word much. Pacifying the mind. It doesn't sound like the purest kind of dharma. Pacifying the mind. We want to awaken the mind. But evidently he's talking about this reaching a state of no mind, of stillness, of samadhi, and from that, out of that samadhi, awakening to the mind. Well, what he's saying here, this distinction between cultivating the path and pacifying mind reminds me of people who endeavor to do precept practice. This is one of the commitments that some people make for our term intensives. It's all right as far as it goes, especially if there are one or two precepts that are bedeviling one on a consistent basis. But it's not the real thing. It's not the Dharma. Isn't it really basically thinking about a particular precept or two or three? This, I would say, is what he calls cultivating the path, making a practice out of something that is does not yet reach the ground, the essence of the matter. And that would be seeing beyond the precepts, getting to see the source of all moral systems, that which is beyond such structures, the world of formlessness. This is Zazen. It's not trying to be a better person. That's not Zazen. That's not Zen practice. He continues, even if you practice the six paramitas, expound the sutras, sit in meditation, and advance energetically practicing austerities, this is just called being good. It is not called Dharma practice. If you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called Dharma practice. So he's, I think he's referring to the mind of grasping, where we desire to be better people. But really in Zen, we're trying to see beyond personhood, beyond the self. It's not just self-improvement. So long as we are striving to become a better person, this he suggests is irrigating the karmic field. It's creating good karma. Yes, it's creating good karma. But ultimately, practice offers us the way to transcend that, transcend good karma and bad karma. All right, we'll resume with this tomorrow, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.